Good morning and welcome to Shattering Myths, the program that's devoted to those of you who have come to realize that all of the world's religious, political, economic, military, and media institutions are corrupt, that they're actually counterproductive. They cannot be resolved. They do not deserve your allegiance. In fact, God wants you to disassociate from them. I am Yada. If you'd like to engage any time over the next 2 hours, you're more than welcome to call our toll-free number 300. Was it 877-7645? Should have that number emblazoned into my skull. Hello, Kirk. My pleasure to be with you. We're going to start on the first hour in Proverbs 6, a diatribe against religion and politics, against hierarchical structures of human organizations, against deceit by Yahweh.
I even found another thing it's against.
What is that?
Well, when you think about an ant colony, it is a society that is totally functioning as a made up of specialists. Now, society functions according to that would function much, much better when we all specialize, which is contrary to the belief that we need to all go back and be our own little farmer and do everything ourselves. You could never reach all these different things. You'd be so busy just trying to survive that society doesn't function that well at all.
Yeah, or the idea that is being promoted by political correctness that little girls ought to strive to achieve like little boys, and that little boys ought not be assertive in their striving to accomplish things. So little boys have been neutered, and little girls have been empowered. Now, I have no problem with a woman seeking to run a business if they wish to do so. But, this is the idea that in the ant colony, everyone has a specialty. Every individual has a specialty. They do their specialty. And thereby they contribute to the greater good. Women are vastly better as mothers than men are. That is especially. Men have larger body masses, denser muscles, thicker bones, and we are better at hard labor, if you will, work, toil to produce food or shelter for the family than are women. We ought to do what we're best at.
I agree with that 100%. Because I mean, if you watch a dad watch a kid fall down, he just looks at the kid like, okay, now what are you going to do?
Yeah, really.
And the mom is like, oh, are you all right? You know, that tells you right there that where the mindset is. Yeah. But I think
one dads of typically will lift up their son. They'll dust their son off, stand the son on their feet, and say, let's go get him again.
Yeah.
Let's get back on the bike. Let's get back on and start running or whatever we're doing. Start walking again. It's about it's not about falling down. It's about getting up. And that's what a father will instruct. The mother will try to comfort. Oh, let's take care of the wound and the hug and the love. Yeah, I know that hurt. Let me see if I can take away the hurt by love. Now, both have a place. But if every time that you fall down, you find acceptance and love in the falling down and the failing to achieve, then you're not going to have the kind of character that will push yourself up when you do take a tumble.
Definitely.
And so you need both. And that is part of the ant.
I would also point out that when people start talking about, the empowering of little girls and things like that, they always throw out the word equality, and equality apparently doesn't mean what I think it means. I'm in my mind, equality means that I get the same things you get, and there's
equal opportunity.
No difference between it.
Right.
But somewhere along the lines, equality became special privileges.
Correct.
It's all right for a little girl to be forceful and bossy, but if a little boy does it, he's being intimidating.
The whole idea of like Title IX. Title IX says since women can't compete in sports where we turn a blind eye to gender, then what we're going to do is we're going to create a second level of sports that only women can apply to, and they have to have as many scholarships as do the men, and that men cannot contribute nor can they qualify on the women's teams, but there has to be a number, because we have to create an artificial equality as opposed to even opportunity. You know, even opportunity means you got a sports team, but the sports team can raise money for the university or the high school or whatever it might be, that you would compensate those who devote their skill to said team. That would be equal opportunity, regardless of gender, regardless of race, regardless of anything other than their ability to play the game appropriately and well. But no Title IX. It's equality is we're just going to have things be equal without recognizing that the contributions and the abilities are not. So it's kind of like the participation trophy in sports. We all participated. Pathetic.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the primary reason, and Yao was very clear about this, that there were two reasons that were primary to him telling us to observe the ants and become wise. And those two reasons were that you are vastly better off without any allegiance to a government, to any president or king or national or religious leader, that if you don't show any respect for or any allegiance to a pope, a president, a king, a priest, a pastor, a general, a governor, then you're vastly better off. And number two, if you engage and act, open your eyes and get off your couch and take the opportunity to prepare in advance for the challenges that will come. And in his case, he uses the gathering of and harvesting of food in the summer by the ant to prepare for leaner times, to convey the idea that while you've got the opportunity, get off your ever-loving behind and take the time to prepare yourself for the lies that will be perpetrated in the name of politics and religion or military endeavors by reading the Torah. And it's very clear. The antidote is the Torah and its covenant. And you need to prepare yourself in advance. Otherwise, you're going to be swept away by the deceit.
And there's no way to mistranslate that, the reading of the Torah.
No, it is simply the reading of the Torah. And in fact, this is the, after saying, here's the things that I detest, he says, my son, closely observe and attentively focus on the directions and terms of the binding covenant contract of your father. And do not ever actually forgo or reject. Do not ever negate or disassociate from the Torah, which is the teaching of your mother. Now, these aren't our actual parents. My dad never once spoke of the covenant, its directions or its conditions, never once. My mother never once spoke to me of the Torah, its teaching or guidance, ever. But my Heavenly Father definitely has provided guidance and directions regarding the terms and conditions of his covenant in his Torah. And my spiritual mother, the Ruach Kodesh, the set-apart spirit, has provided marvelous insights into the teaching and guidance found in Yahweh's Torah. So you got to know who the father and mother is here and who's speaking. Matter of fact, I got an email from a fellow who's an astute individual. And he said that, you know, that I have previously said that Solomon wasn't inspired. So this religious material ascribes this proverb to Solomon. You know, what do you have to say about that? And my response was, this word picture, this expression, vivid expression of a instruction that it becomes easy to remember based on the way that it's phrased. Didn't come from the scribe. Doesn't matter who wrote it. That's like crediting Moshe with the Torah.
Mm-hmm. Here's a difference.
In fact, it's Moshe. You can at least ascribe to the Torah because the Devarim is Moshe's words, Moshe's commentary on Yahweh's Torah. But
mm-hmm.
in this case, the speaker isn't Solomon. The speaker isn't Dod. The speaker isn't an individual that we would ascribe to a man. The speaker here is our Heavenly Father, Yahweh. And so it doesn't matter who the scribe was. What matters is who's the speaker. And plus the fact there is no proof of any kind that this proverb was written, scribed by Solomon. All I really said was that Ecclesiastes, for certain, and because it's in conflict with the Iowa's overall message, and perhaps and likely the Song of Solomon, is not inspired and shouldn't be part of your Torah prophets and Psalms.
But where that leaves you, though, you still back to the same question, either God's line or Paul's line.
Correct. Yeah, this is it's unequivocal here. And the very fact that Yahweh has now made the fulcrum of the argument, observing the Torah and its one and only covenant, along with its guidance and terms and conditions, in contrast to what he said just a moment of, or in context with what he said a moment before, which was that this individual claiming to be sent out as an apostle will break and breach and annul something vitally important. Well, Paul is the one who annulled the covenant and created a new one, and who annulled the Torah, creating a new testament. That's Paul, man.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only Paul. There's no one else in human history that fits that bogus bill.
Right.
I mean, I can give you a month of Shabbats, and you could devote 24 hours a day, 7 days a week to it, or hopefully 6 days a week to it, and you would not find anyone else who fits this prophecy.
No. He's the most quoted man. Everybody attributes Christianity to him, and
yep.
that's the message.
Right, and Christianity definitely has its the annulled Torah that no longer applies to the Christians because they're under Paul's gospel of grace, salvation through faith, and not of works, not of the Torah, not of acting upon the Torah. And so, and it's definitely a new testament, a new covenant to Pauline Christians. Oops.
Oops.
Yep, then Yahweh just says that because he wants to make certain that he's communicating to everybody. Everything he says has to be applicable to everybody that is listening to him throughout time. So this had to communicate to someone 3,000 years ago, as well as someone examining every yod and tittle, every stroke and every letter of the Hebrew to understand it today. And he says so. Since he has used the human anatomy to convey the things that he hates, he's also going to use the human anatomy to convey some fatherly advice. But he's not talking about, you know, us just because he mentioned visions of grandeur and haughty eyes and hands that kill and feet that are impulsively going astray. That he's not telling you you should condemn or cut off your feet or gouge out your eyes or cut off your hand.
No.
They're metaphors, mm-hmm. you know, for human behavior that he hates. Well, now he's going to provide a metaphor. He's not telling you that you ought to take your Torah and rather than reading it, that you ought to make a necklace out of it when he says this. I mean, folks, you've got to be able to think through why something is being said, and it's almost always best understood symbolically.
Mm-hmm.
Choose to unceasingly fasten them physically or mentally tie, bind, and join them, closely associating with them. This was Kashar, written in the call stem, which creates a genuine relationship. Imperfect, which depicts that which is ongoing, and imperative, which is the mood of volition in the second person, and thus expressing the choice and desire of God's children. So choose to unceasingly, without interruption, forever, fasten them upon your heart. Now Kirk is understood best when you're capable of making connections.
Right.
When did Yahweh tell us? Has Yahweh ever told us something about the Torah and our heart? Is there any comment between Yahweh and our heart and the Torah that would help us understand what he's saying here?
Well, it's the final object when the in 33 and 20, 33 when he's going to put it in our hearts.
Yep. The single most prophetic, most important prophetic pronouncement regarding the covenant. I think that beyond the covenants, you know, after we deal with the covenant's formation.
Mm-hmm.
And the guidance to how you participate in the covenant and the presentation of the covenant's five terms and conditions and five benefits in the opening book of the Torah in Bereshith, between Yahweh and Abraham. The next most important declaration, I think, regarding the Torah is its reaffirmation with its renewal as promised upon Yahweh's return.
Right.
And what we find is that it's in Jeremiah 31, where Yahweh says that he's going to reaffirm his Torah, not with a Gentile group of people, not with a church, with Yisrael and Yahudah, uniting not only Yisrael and Yahudah back together because they were severed in Hosea,
mm-hmm.
and pronounced divorced, but and not my children. But he says, you know, that they are going to be cured and they will become his children and that the divorce will be reconciled. He's now talking about the reconciliation of that divorce between one another and between them and him via the covenant. And he says that at that time, he's going to reaffirm his covenant upon his return and with specifically Yisrael and Yahudah. He's going to renew his and reaffirm his covenant and that there'll be one difference between the covenant that is presented in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, the family-oriented relationship, and the covenant as it will exist on that day. Only one difference. This is the thing that's so stunning to me about Christianity that claims that this is the pronouncement of their New Testament. And yet the one thing that is different affirms that Pauline Christianity is manure. Yeah, just an absolute crock, a complete and total fraud. And it's amazing to me that Christians holding up this is going to be a new covenant, different than the old one, and they don't read the next line, or they don't read the line that precedes it with whom is it being established, and it's with Yisrael and Yahudah, not with the Gentile church, and that they don't read what follows. What is the one difference, Kirk?
It's where what he places in their hearts.
He writes his Torah inside of us, right on our hearts. So if you want to understand this fastening the Torah to your heart, you need to understand it in context with what Yahweh is going to do. Now we, of our own volition, that's why this was written to express volition. We, of our own volition, can do this. We can incorporate the Torah's guidance and teaching into our very nature and as well as the terms and conditions of the covenant. We can incorporate that into our very nature.
And he suggests you do it in the morning and when you lay down at night.
Yeah. So we can choose to do that.
Yeah.
That's our choice. When he returns, everyone who will survive his return will have already made that choice. And so at that point, rather than us doing our best to incorporate the Torah the best we understand it, into the fabric of our lives, Yah was going to provide a perfect edition of his Torah teaching and directions inside of us. Now, the reason he can't do that now is if he did that now, then the mood here, which is volition, would be nullified. You'd have no choice. You know, that would be like the cow that is branded.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't have a choice. Once it's branded, it's always branded. Didn't have a choice. But human souls, we all have a choice. We were born under the auspices of free will. And so we can choose to ignore or reject or accept Yahweh's Torah. And here God is saying, my advice to you is don't ever ignore it. Don't ever reject it. And instead incorporate it into the very fabric of your life.
Otherwise, you're totally unarmed.
Correct. Ill-prepared, unarmed, and estranged.
Mm-hmm.
Unsaved.
That's right.
So choose to unceasingly fasten them, that would be the terms and conditions of the covenant and the Torah's teaching, upon your heart, continually electing of your own free will to place them as an adornment around your neck. Now, the reason he chose neck is, where would you check for a person's pulse?
Well, the best is right there at the neck, because the carotid artery.
The word, right there. So, well, what about the nefesh, the Hebrew word for soul?
Breath.
Isn't it also breath?
Breath, yeah.
You breathe in and breathe out through your neck.
Breathe in.
Where do you? Where does one swallow nourishment?
Once again,
either
through the throat,
poison or good. And where does one either? Use their larynx, their capacity to create words that are either truthful or deceitful. Where do they come from?
It's always right there.
So if your throat is guided by Yahweh's Torah instructions, it is far more likely that you're going to communicate that which is true and reliable and right than that which is wrong. You're going to ingest that which is good and nourishing, not that which is poisonous.
It's a perfect metaphor.
It's a perfect metaphor, isn't it? Particularly for your soul. Imagine that. You buy Nutramedical's snake oil, and your body will be rid of all pathogens. Talk about trying to sell people false hope. And what in the world is wrong with you? You know, if you can't market your product honestly, then maybe you ought not be selling it.
Can I just make a quick comment about vitamins? I mean,
yeah.
They did a study, and there's only about a couple of them that are worth a darn that they recommend studies over years and lots of people. But regardless, if you had a product that you were making and it could do all the things you do, you claim they do, why wouldn't you have it tested? Why do they always say this hasn't been tested by anybody? If I could make those claims based on the truth by having it tested, I'd set the world on fire. I'd be the richest guy in town.
Correct.
So that should be a clue.
Yeah. Well, you know, the fact is that that minerals and vitamins we get in our diet.
Sure.
It's just part of the diet. And if you have a reasonably balanced diet, you're going to get the minerals and the vitamins that you need.
And
now, if you want to take a modest supplement, a very modest supplement, you know, have at it. Not a problem to do that. But understand that doing anything but a very modest, cheap supplement, all it's going to do, as Sheldon Cooper would say on the Big Bang Theory, is cause you to have very expensive pee. And so this idea that there's a miracle cure, a pill that you can take that will solve all your ailments, no. The fact is that you need to eat right. You need to know what you're eating. You need to think about what you're eating. That's why God says, you know, eat whatever you want, so long as you're thoughtful about it. You need to prepare it properly. You need to have a well-balanced, nutritious diet. And you need to exercise. You need to get off your behind and be industrious. And you need to exercise your mind to keep yourself healthy. And
alert. Yeah.
That's the instruction, and there is no pill, no ointment, no concoction that's going to remove those instructions from being valid. You know, God's constantly saying, exercise your eyes, exercise your mind, exercise your body, engage, act. That's what this whole psalm is about, or this proverb is about. You know, oh, you lethargic and lazy one. You know, get up. What's it going to take for you to get up, for you to be awakened, for you to take a stand? You know, and the basis of that stand is understanding the guidance and directions that are in the Torah and acting upon the terms and conditions of the covenant. And when he speaks of food, he's speaking of that which is nourishing versus that which is poisonous. With poisonous, it's religion, politics, militarism, patriotism, the deceptions of man. So he says here, in your walking, she will continuously guide and lead you. She will always direct you, creating a favorable opportunity for you. But keep in mind here, this is the thing that, you know, so many people, again, they want they don't want to have to engage. They don't want to have to act. They don't have to do something because, you know, Christianity, you know, it's what's in your heart that matters. And it's whether or not you've been good, and salvation is a free gift, and it's by faith, not by knowing or understanding or acting. When she says, in your walking, she will continuously lead and guide you. Context. What is she leading you and guiding you through?
The Mitzvah, the Torah.
And the Torah. It's the Torah of your mother, right?
Mm-hmm.
So she is guiding you through life, through the Torah. Does the Torah have a path that it recommends you follow?
Indeed it does. Starts at Passover.
Yeah, ends at Sukkah, right?
Mm-hmm. Ends at Sukkah.
And is it coming into the light of our spiritual mother, an essential part of those instructions and of that path?
If you want to be protected from, you have to have the light covering you.
Yeah, it's constantly saying, answer the invitation and come into the presence.
The light.
Yeah, of the feminine manifestation of the light. Set apart spirit.
Let me toss in one more thing, because in my studies last night, I was doing some translating a little deeper into each one of these words. In particular, the first one I did was halak, which is walk.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I compared that with how we would say walk, it just occurs to me over and over how rich the Hebrew language is versus the English language, which is so limiting. So I looked up walk and, you know, and prepare yourself, walk, go in a direction, everything. But here's the things in the oldest roots about walk, halak. And they're these, and just notice the richness in the word for walk versus halak for the word we use as walk.
Mm-hmm.
It says a staff in a hand, support in walking, a weapon to defend against predators and thieves, which is exactly what he's talking about here.
And what's the middle letter of halak?
Halak is, well, you have...
the middle letter is lamed, right?
Yes. Uh-huh.
And what is the lamed?
Lamed is the leading, is the staff.
Right.
And, you know.
So what you've just said is that the definition of the word is predicated on the letters which comprise the word.
Right.
But the staff that protects, the staff that leads, the staff that enables your walk to be stable and upright is the middle of the word.
Right. True.
And by the way, the first letter in the word, isn't that a person standing up, walking?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, the letter itself is defined by halak, which is a person upright, standing up, walking, reaching up, engaged. Correct?
Mm-hmm. And it goes on to, you know, walking a journey and lifestyle, customs, traveling journey. I mean, it just, to me, when you, the beauty of studying these words is just the fun of, my gosh, I don't know how you could Well, Yahweh can, but you have to, what an imagination that he has chosen a word that goes back 4,000 years,
mm-hmm.
or 6,000 years, and it's the very word of walking has all these connotations. Now, you're excellent when you do it because you also put in parentheses on your literature, on your translation, you put an awful lot of this in there as well. I just also look at the little letters and things, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's just amazing how it all goes into a sentence that he's talking about. At the end of this Proverbs, we're getting into, okay, you understand all that. Now, this is what I'll do for you. This is the promise.
Yes. What was the first time that Yahweh spoke of walking, of when he asked, encouraged, instructed someone to walk? Who was that, and where were they walking either to or from?
Well, they're walking to the place that he's provided for them,
right?
But they're walking away from society and all this.
Right, from their country,
right?
From Babel, from confusion, from being with Baal. That's the first time he uses the walk. He's encouraging Abram, who became Abraham, to walk away from Babel, from being with Baal, from the root of Babel, from being owned and controlled by Hasatan, the adversary, to walk away from confusion and corruption, from your country, he says specifically. Walk away and walk to the place that I've provided. And the whole path through Pesach, Matzah, Bukurim, Shabuah, Teruah, Kippurim, and Sukkah, the seven invitations to meet with God, it is a path that Yahweh asks us to walk.
Yeah, we're supposed to, those are just signs along the way of the path.
Right. And so if the set-apart spirit, our spiritual mother, is going to guide us by way of the Torah in our walk, the walk that she is going to, that she guides us in, is the walk that begins at the doorway labeled Passover. The doorway to life, over the threshold that is matzah, which is the means to cleanse us of our rebellion, of our guilt, so that we are freed. And then to the promise of Bukurim, to be firstborn children, and to the family, covenant family of Yahweh, so that we can be on Shabuah, the promise of the Shabbat, enriched, empowered by the Spirit. And then on Teruah, we convey what we have come to know to a world that has twisted and perverted God's testimony, warning them as well as announcing this path which leads to Kippurim. And Kippurim is the very thing that he's talking about in Yirmiyah 31.
Mm-hmm.
He's returning on Kippurim, the Day of Reconciliations, where he's reconciling his relationship with Israel and Yehudah. And reconciling them into the covenant. Where we're specifically on, twice he says, come into the presence of the maternal manifestation of my light.
Kodesh, yes.
Yeah, so that we can camp out with him, Sukkah, coming into the promised land just as he invited Abraham. Pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
Accompanying you, this is now in your walking, she will guide you, accompanying you when you rest. She will watch over you. This is interesting, that when you're resting, when you lie down, we rest during the Shabbat.
Yes.
We'll have our Shabbat program this evening. It's a time of rest and reflection.
Mm-hmm.
She's watching over us, that even when we are idle, her garment of light protects us. So we're protected, we're watched over, we're guarded, even when we are resting, when we benefit from, when we act upon the guidance of the Torah.
And you need to get recharged. I mean, that's what that's what they do with the sheep. They take them to the pastures and waters and lead them all down there, and then they let them eat, and then they rest for a while. Then they move on.
I had lunch with Yoel yesterday. He's the fellow that that was my partner in creating my previous company, Value America, and he was also the gentleman responsible for establishing all the websites where the books are made available. And he was talking about a friend of his that came from Guatemala. And he said in Guatemala, when they would kids to a movie. They would have to take the entire movie theater, and there would be more bodyguards than there would be kids. That when their kids go to school, there'll be two guards in two cars preceding the car with their child, and two guards in two cars following their child on the way to school. That when there's a wedding, there are somewhere between 5 and 10 times more bodyguards than there are actual attendees, invitees to the wedding. It's become so bad with people being kidnapped as a means to extract a ransom. And it tells you is that if you're outside of the covenant, man's vicious. And you need protection outside of the covenant. In the covenant, you have protection. You know, I've done the thing, Kirk, that would cause you to be most vulnerable in this world. There is no group of people that consistently act as viciously as Muslims. And their primary motivation to attack is to insult Muhammad, the Quran, and Allah, and Islam. And you could not be more condemning of Allah, the Quran, Muhammad, and Islam than Prophet of Doom or the 3,000 radio programs that I've done on that subject. And yet, unlike any of the others who have embarked on that mission, I'm the only one without a bodyguard. I'm the only one who did it in my own name, not in hiding. Why? I've got the best protection in the universe. There is nothing a troop of people with arms could do that would provide better protection than what I already have. That's why it doesn't require any courage.
I'm glad to hear you say that. We were talking about that the other night. It's more than just protection against the religious nutcases, but it's protecting you against everything. Everything
right.
that will harm you, whether it
Correct.
Be military, whether it be government.
Correct.
So we
Correct.
Should be brave and bold.
Yeah. It's the Torah's instructions that we are empowered to understand through the counsel of the set-apart spirit, the enlightenment of the set-apart spirit, that provides the antidote for every one of society's poisons. Religious, political, patriotic, military, economic, media, academic, all of them. And she's constantly protecting us when we focus on the right thing. Then it says here, accompanying you when you rest, she will watch over you. And when you awake, when you arise, she will communicate with you, enabling you to seriously consider the situation and the instructions. She is like steroids for our nesama. Our nesama is different than our nefesh. Our nefesh is our soul or consciousness. Our nesama is our conscience, and therefore the ability to deduce right from wrong, good and bad, prudent and imprudent. And so if we are observing the Torah, if we incorporate the Torah and its covenant into the very fabric of our lives, and we listen to our Heavenly Father about His family, and we are enlightened by our spiritual mother regarding Yahweh's Torah teaching, then she, and by the way, Torah and mitzvah and covenant, Bereb, are all feminine nouns. So she will communicate with you. The Torah will communicate with you. The set-apart spirit will communicate with you. The spiritual mother, who is the set-apart spirit, will communicate with you. The covenant, the Torah, all will communicate with you to seriously consider the situation and instructions. Direct your attention to the content for guidance, focusing you on the apparent thought behind it, pondering the reasons for it. Here the call stem denotes a literal interpretation of the actual communication and consideration, and the imperfect conjugation conveys an ongoing state, a thought-provoking exchange that goes on continuously for all time. This is, by the way, the same set of parts spirit, the same spiritual mother that caused Yahusha to be the diminished manifestation of Yahweh, that left Yahweh before his body perished on the upright pole of Passover.
Pretty heady stuff.
Yeah, exactly. For indeed, the prescriptions and conditions of the covenant, the mitzvah, the directions and terms of the binding contract, the instructions from a father to his children regarding the family, are a lamp illuminated by olive oil, and the Torah is a light. They are the way of lives for rational discourse and for being right. There's more, but I don't even want to go on before we comment on these things.
Okay.
So he's saying that the prescriptions and conditions of the covenant, the mitzvah, the directions in terms of the binding contract, the instructions from a father to his children regarding the family, are a light illuminated by olive oil, a lamp.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got the light speaks of, and he says, and the Torah is a light.
Mm-hmm.
Now, or light is the means, that's the inclusive word for all forms of light.
Light, yeah.
Okay? Or light is the Hebrew word for light and all forms. You know, when Yahweh says, he spoke light into existence,
mm-hmm.
and there was light, and that he is equated to light, light is the big picture. Light is, from Yahweh's perspective, is the essence of the universe and essence of his nature, and it is what we are going to become. Light. That's the big picture or. But a lamp produces light. But it produces light in a very individual way.
Mm-hmm.
And he's using a lamp that burns olive oil, which is synonymous with the set apart spirit.
That's fair. Uh-huh.
Because it was the purest form of light in the ancient world. And it burned cleanly, and it was also, as olive oil, nutritious, and it could be put on as a salve to promote healing.
Right.
So it had all of the metaphors for the enlightenment and the healing and the protection and the nourishment provided by the set-apart spirit. But the lamp is an individual thing, right?
It is. I was just going to say, and the two letters are pretty telling as well, because you have a nun and a rosh, which is a continuation of the thinking person.
Yes. Yeah, the nun is the sperm. It's the individual born with an inheritance, and the rosh is as an individual who's using their eyes and ears to see and listen, and therefore their head to think so that they understand. But the point I want to make is that there is, while the Torah includes the mitzvah, the terms and conditions and the directions regarding the family of Yahweh, the family of Yahweh is very much individual. It's not we are part of a family. Each of us came into that family individually. We all collectively are a lamp creating the greater illumination that is part of that family. But the covenant itself, the family, and becoming part of it, walking through the doorway of Pesach and across the cleansing threshold of Matzah to become a firstborn child on Bukkudim, to be enriched and empowered by Yahweh, is all an individual thing.
We do it
single file with Yahweh, and us individually. When you did it on your own.
Yes.
Terry, your wife, did it on her own.
Exactly.
I ended up in the same place. I did it on my own. We ended up in the same place. the mitzvah is a subset of the Torah. The Torah is the big picture.
Mm-hmm.
The Torah is the totality of Yahweh's instructions and guidance and teaching. It's the big light, where the lamp is a subset of that light.
Mm-hmm.
Just as we individually are part of Yahweh's family, but collectively, you know, we are a much bigger entity than we are individually. But this is presented as lamp and or light because of the difference in scale of those things. And there, mitzvah and Torah, while they are used somewhat interchangeably, they aren't the same. The mitzvah is a subset of the Torah. The mitzvah is the specific instructions and guidance regarding the specific terms and conditions of one specific thing presented in the Torah. The familial relationship known as the covenant. So he says that that's the light. If you snuff it out, if you annul it, as Pauline Christianity does, you've got no way to see. He also says they are the way of lives, plural. Not only of this life, your mortal existence, making it far more richer and more enlightened, but for all eternity, and for rational discourse.